Hello and welcome back to the Killer Kind podcast. Before we get into it, I just want to let you know that this is a part two to the Lululemon murder. So if you haven't listened to part one, I highly recommend you go back and check that out first. I went over everything found at the crime scene, how the girls were found the following morning, and everything that took place at the start of the investigation. So be sure to go check that out first. Now with that out of the way, I hope you guys enjoyed last week's episode. I know a few of you mentioned you have already heard about this case and know what happened, but then I was surprised by those that said they hadn't heard of it. So you're in for a wild ride today if you don't know how this case ends. With that said, let's go ahead and dive into part two of the murder of Jana Murray. So last week, as I mentioned, a Lululemon store manager, Rachel, found one of her employees, Jana Murray, brutally murdered on Saturday morning, March 12th, 2011. The surviving employee, Brittany Norwood, was found bound and left near the body of her coworker. Brittany gave this horrific story to police that two masked men came in after closing the Lululemon store on Bethesda Row in Maryland. She said one of the men raped her, tortured her by cutting her with a box cutter, and hitting her over the head with a Buddha statue. Then, both men beat and stabbed her fellow coworker to death, but spared Brittany's life. Investigators thought they had their men when they pulled the security footage from the Apple store next door, but it turned out that they were just two restaurant workers who happened to pass by the time of the attack. So, unfortunately, their only suspects were cleared. There were Apple store workers next door that heard the majority of the attack taking place through the wall that night, but never reported it to police or went over to check on the two women. Other than that, nobody ever saw or heard anything. All police had to go off was this statement given by Brittany Norwood. So that kind of leads us into part two, because police were out of leads, no witnesses, and not sure where to turn next to find these killers. So they lay out the case files. They all kind of gather in a room together and decide to regroup. And that's when they start to realize things just aren't adding up. And if you listen to part one, I'm curious if anything stood out to you as odd. As I mentioned briefly towards the end of part one, the weapons used in the murder were oddly all from inside the Lululemon store itself. So did the two men in ski masks really not bring any weapons for a robbery? There was no sign of a weapon used to enter the store, meaning no crowbar or heavy object to break the glass with. I mean, it's possible they took that item or items back with them when they left, and maybe they didn't bring any weapons because they didn't expect anyone to be there, but it's just odd to me that they chose to brutally attack two women with no weapons on hand. They just so happened to have everything they needed to kill someone and tie them up with at the store. Because, like I said, Brittany was found tied with zip ties around her hands and feet. Those zip ties came from inside the Lululemon store. There was a whole bag of them kept near the toolbox. But not only that, Brittany described this as a very quick attack. And you'll hear me say that a few times. She described this as a very fast situation. So how did they find the zip ties, a toolbox, and a rope in such a short amount of time? I doubt these kind of things were just kind of out in the open. I'm sure they were tucked away. It just didn't make sense. Again, it's possible we were dealing with some dumb criminals here, but like I mentioned in the last episode, based on all the evidence thus far, police believed that their killer was organized and very particular with everything they did during the attack and especially afterwards. Plus, we need to go back over the amount of injuries Jana sustained. It was 331 injuries, with at least five different weapon patterns found on her body during the autopsy. I believe it was broken down during court how long it would take for someone to hit someone 331 times. So if someone is hit that many times, estimating one hit per second, it would take them about 5.5 minutes. However, we know Jaina's killer switched weapons at least 5 times, which would be odd if Jaina is staying in one particular spot. Is her killer just switching up weapons for no particular reason? What's the point in that? And when I first read this, I assumed that it appeared that Jaina was trying to get away, and the killer was just sort of grabbing what they could as they were chasing her. But again, according to Brittany's story, she never mentioned that Jaina was running around the shop. She insinuated that she was just taken into this other room and was beaten, maybe kicking and screaming, but not really moving around. And going back to the attack itself, it was later determined, like I mentioned in court, that if the killer was switching weapons, the attack likely lasted close to 20 minutes. I think it was broken down to like 17 minutes and something, based on Jaina fighting back and based on the fact the killer had to switch weapons multiple times. So 20 minutes of an attack like this. 20 minutes. And when thinking about this, investigators were likely thinking it takes a lot of built-up anger for someone to willingly attack another person for almost 20 minutes. If you're a criminal, especially one that seems to just want to rob a place, the goal 90% of the times that we hear about, they just want to get in and get out, right? So why go through all of this? For what? Maybe a few $100 in cash? And like, what are you so mad about that you're seemingly in a blind rage for over 17, almost 20 minutes? It just doesn't make sense. And I'm probably going to say that too many times in this episode, so prepare yourself. But moving on. One thing I didn't mention during part one was what police found out from Rachel about the 2 sets of bloody footprints. Or really the size 14 shoe found at the scene that caused the bigger shoe prints, more specifically. So when police spoke to the store manager, Rachel, they were sort of going over everything that they had found at the scene. And they mentioned the size 14 shoe. They show Rachel a picture of this size 14 tennis shoe found at the scene with blood on it. Okay. And Rachel's like, oh, don't worry about those because they belong to the store. Those wouldn't be the attacker's shoes or anything like that because that was Lululemon property. And police are kind of taken aback because they thought for sure that they were a pair of shoes ditched by one of the attackers. But Rachel explained that those were a pair of shoes they kept at the store for people to try on with new leggings or whatever they were going to buy that day, because most of the time people are going to be wearing tennis shoes. So if they come into the store wearing heels, they're going to want to try on the new leggings with some tennis shoes, okay? And the reason that they're a size 14 was that it's pretty much the biggest size you can get, right? One of the bigger sizes. So nobody's going to come in and not be able to fit in this tennis shoe. It may look a little silly, but at least they can kind of get the idea. So once again, investigators are sort of scratching their heads because it would make zero sense for one of these attackers to come in, remove their own shoes, and put on these Lululemon shoes. Someone made the comment that maybe they didn't want their own shoe prints in the blood. But once again, I'm going to remind you, Brittany made this sound like a very quick attack. She described almost every move these two men made. And she didn't mention seeing them changing shoes. And it just seems like the more and more police dug into Brittany's story, the more inconsistencies they found, the more they realized they weren't able to confirm everything she was telling them. So let's take a moment to regroup, shall we? First, everything used in the murder was Lululemon property. Then there was the fact that Jaina was brutally and viciously murdered, and Brittany walked away with a few minor scratches. Then you have ear witness statements from the Apple store claiming, again, only hearing 2 women screaming, never hearing a male's voice. And according to Brittany's story, the 2 men, or at least her attacker, was yelling racial slurs at her and threatening to know where she lived. She even claimed they knew her address, which also kind of led into more of a rabbit hole, which made investigators believe the attack was meant for her, even though that doesn't make any sense at all, because supposedly the two men came into the store after the two women returned to the store to get Brittany's Metro card. So if the attack was meant for Brittany, the two men only got lucky because nobody was even supposed to be there at the time. So all that said, again, things just don't add up and it's not looking good for our girl Brittany. They start to think she was in on the attack for some reason or another. Why? Not sure. Because they start thinking maybe she made sure the door was left open so that the attackers could come in the first place. Maybe she let them know where the weapons would be, including the toolbox. And did she help them get the big tennis shoes for them to wear? And maybe there was only one attacker because there were smaller shoe prints found and then one larger shoe print. So more than likely, that could have been Brittany's shoe and then the bigger shoe was the other attacker's. So police want to find out a little bit more about Brittany, sort of her backstory, any history of criminal activity, that sort of a thing. So Brittany Norwood was born in Seattle, Washington on May 19th, 1982, and she was one of nine siblings. She was born into a very large family. They were all very close, and Brittany seemed to have a very happy childhood. Her father owned his own business, and for a family that size, they had a comfortable amount of money. They weren't super rich, but they were semi-wealthy, and everybody was taken care of. There were a few brushes with the law that started around 2005 when she reportedly was cited for speeding in Maryland and failed to show up for her court appearance. Getting a little bit more heavy, in 2006, Brittany had been dating a guy by the name of Mari Branch, and their relationship headed towards the end. Mari would later report that after the two broke up, he started dating someone else, and Brittany began harassing and even stalking him and his new girlfriend. An official restraining order was filed against Brittany in 2007 for that reason. Apparently, she had somehow gotten his new girlfriend's number and been harassing her. At one point, Brittany had actually broken into Mari's house, stole his girlfriend's phone, and physically assaulted him on multiple different occasions. In court records, Mari said Brittany Norwood needed anger management and, quote, a psychiatric evaluation. A judge had ordered Brittany to stay away from Mari and his new girlfriend, who also filed a complaint. However, just 2 weeks later, the couple caught her following them in her car and filed another complaint. Brittany was ordered back into court for a contempt hearing, but never showed up. Another incident with the law took place in 2008 when Brittany and her former roommate at the time were involved in a dispute with their landlord. Public records indicated that both she and her roommate left the Columbia Heights property that year due to the dispute. So police pretty much discovered there's a lot on Brittany, but they wanted to keep digging, speak to someone that may be on her side. And at first it seemed hard to find close friends of Brittany's. Nobody was really willing to come forward to speak on her behalf, which seemed odd. But police learned that Brittany was a very skilled soccer player in college at Stony Brook University in New York, so they decide to kind of interview some teammates. She was once named Defensive Most Valuable Player during the season. She was given conference honors in 2001 and earned a spot on the NSCAA Adidas All Northeast Region team in 2002. That's a mouthful. However, it was later determined that she didn't have the greatest reputation with her former teammates. She had a reputation of being a liar and thief, according to a former teammate Megan Healy. She said other girls on the team that knew Brittany longer than her told her, quote, "Watch your locker, keep it locked. She's been known to steal things." Another former teammate, Leanna Yust, later told the Washington Post that she and Brittany were once really good friends, but their relationship ended over concerns of Brittany stealing from her. And suspicions of theft did not stop after college. A hairstylist made a comment claiming that Brittany had failed to pay her for a full weave of imported hair. And when she asked for payment, Brittany claimed somebody stole money out of her purse while in the salon. So the hairstylist felt terrible that somebody could have done that at her salon. So she told Brittany, don't worry about it, just pay me back later. However, as time went on, Brittany called to say that she was going to pay her money, that she was going to bring money to her. However, she never did. And when the hairstylist reached out to her through Facebook, Brittany blocked her. And again, the history of theft does not stop there. Brittany had been known to steal from previous workplaces as well. She actually worked at another Lululemon store before working at the one in Bethesda, and apparently she was caught stealing from there. It's unclear to me how you can get hired at another retail store if you're caught stealing from one. But either way, she was hired, and it didn't take long before she had started stealing from the Bethesda store as well. Apparently, the managers, including Rachel and Jaina, were well aware of Brittany's stealing tendencies. And at the time of the attack, they were actually trying to get Brittany fired. Apparently, the higher-ups in the store held a meeting after they received several reports of Brittany stealing from the store, and not just from Lululemon, but also stealing from other coworkers. So during the meeting, it was decided that the next time she was caught or even suspected of stealing by someone, they are to report it to everyone that was there at the meeting. And it didn't take long until she was accused. Literally the day before Jaina Murray was murdered, Jaina told Rachel that she saw Brittany put a pair of leggings in her bag. Now, it is standard practice for the on-duty manager to check employees' bags before they all leave, for stolen property, obviously. So Jaina walks over to Brittany and says that she needs to check her bag. However, Brittany claimed that another employee had already checked her bag, so she didn't need to. Jaina obviously went over to this other coworker and asked if she had indeed checked Brittany's bag, and to no one's surprise, she said that she definitely did not check Brittany's bag, and that she was lying. And that's kind of how it was left between Jaina and Brittany. So police, after gathering all of this information, are wildly suspicious of Brittany. And honestly, they were still trying to focus on the possible scenario that she helped set up an attack, still thinking that she was just involved, but not solely responsible. So they get her back in. And Detective Drury and Reuven called Brittany and asked if she could come to the station to give hair samples and fingerprints so they could remove her from the crime scene, basically rule her out. They also wanted to get her back in for further questioning, so this is kind of like a ruse to get her back in. So Brittany comes into the station with her brother Chris and her sister Marissa on March 16th, less than a week after the murder. Brittany goes into the room alone at first, and both detectives go over a few inconsistencies in her story. And they start with some of the evidence at the scene. They first bring up the zip ties and how they belong to Lululemon. But they ask Brittany, where did the attacker get the zip ties? And she said, oh, I saw one of them grab the zip ties out of his backpack. But then the investigators are like, well, the ones found on your wrist match the ones found at the store. And she immediately was like, oh, I don't know. Maybe he did get them out of his backpack, but they could be from the store. I don't know. That night is just blurry. Investigators also asked if Brittany knew what Jaina's car looked like. And she said no, that she did not. It was shortly after this that Brittany asked to leave, that it was all too hard to talk about, and everything from that night was just blurry. And since they had nothing on her, they let her go. Around the time of this second interview, police receive the forensic test results from Jaina's car. As I mentioned in last episode, they were still waiting on the test results from that forensic search of the car. So they get the test results back, and they find both Jaina and Brittany's blood inside the car, which was something police expected to find because it was assumed the attackers were the ones that moved the car. So that was fine. They were okay with that. What was odd, though, was that they found a baseball cap inside the car that night. and it was believed to belong to one of the men at first, obviously. However, there was a very distinct blood spot on the hat, specifically the inside of the cap, right where your forehead would be, kind of like the top center of your forehead. And if you remember, that's exactly where Brittany's biggest injury was, right in the middle of her forehead. So police were under the assumption that Brittany had been inside that car at some point after the attack. But why? And why lie about not knowing what Brittany's car looked like? So now police are even more convinced that Brittany had something to do with this. Why? Still not sure. And was there even a second attacker? Because they were starting to believe that she may have acted alone. I mean, up until this point, there was no sign of any other person at this scene. I mean, everything that they thought they had showing there's another person just kept proving to be inaccurate. So the team of investigators on the case get together once again, along with a forensic examiner who'd been on the case since the beginning. And the team asks the forensic examiner if he could look back at all of his findings and determine if the evidence found could support this new theory that Brittany was involved. Because when he was first looking into it, obviously he was looking at the case with the thought that there were two attackers and two victims, one of which being a survivor. So the examiner goes back through the evidence they found. And a few more incriminating things against Brittany pop up. One, the zip ties, which we mentioned. If Brittany acted alone, she would have had to put the zip ties around her wrists herself. And the only way really to do that would be to place the ties around your wrist and use your teeth to pull it tight. And sure enough, the zip ties used around her wrist had very obvious teeth marks. Two, the shoe prints. So as I mentioned multiple times, there were two sets of bloody shoe prints found in the store, one being a women's size 5 or 6, and the other being a men's size 14. Now originally, both of these were believed to belong to two different attackers, or at least one being Brittany's, possibly, and the other being one of the men from that night. If it had been two men involved in the attack, those shoe prints would have been overlapping. The smaller one on top of the other, and then vice versa, the bigger ones overlapping the smaller. However, when they went back to look at these prints, everywhere the shoe prints overlapped, it was the larger shoe print on top of the smaller one. Stay with me here. I know I'm kind of getting into the weeds here. But this basically insinuated that whoever was wearing the smaller shoes walked around the room first and then likely changed into the bigger shoes and walked over where they had previously left prints, kind of to disguise the shoe prints or at least make it look like a second person had been there. The third thing the examiner pointed out was the blood surrounding Brittany's body. When going back over the crime scene photos, they looked closer at the small puddles of blood in the bathroom where Brittany was found. And it looked more like smeared blood than puddles. Plus, why was there so much blood in the bathroom with Brittany? She had fairly minor injuries, so there should have been much less blood found in the room than there was. The examiner speculated that Brittany likely used the paper towels found at the scene to smear Jaina's blood in the bathroom where Brittany was found to make it look like that she had bled more than she actually did. And that sort of leads to the last bit of evidence against Brittany, her injuries. So we all know of these superficial injuries that she had, the slice marks that she said were made by her attacker torturing her. Well, when looking back at her wounds, they weren't consistent with an attack. They appeared to be self-inflicted due to the angle of each mark. Then there was one other significant injury that required stitches. There was an injury on her hand between her thumb and pointer finger. After taking a look at her injuries through photos taken that day, that particular injury looked more like someone who had gripped a blade and cut their hand open. Or like in this case, someone who might have been holding a knife and their hand slipped down onto the blade, cutting their hand. To me, that tells us all we need to know. I feel like we don't cover many cases where someone was stabbed to death, but in most stabbing deaths, police look at their suspect's hands to see if there's any recent injuries, because it's known that if you are stabbing someone with force repeatedly, that the knife in your hand will become slippery over time and the attacker's hand will sort of slip down the handle of the knife down onto the blade and cause cuts on their hand. I've seen this multiple times in murders where the attacker used a knife. The day after the March 16th interview, Detective Drury on the case gets a call from Marissa and Chris Norwood. Again, this is brother and sister of Brittany. And they tell the detective that Brittany was withholding some information because she was afraid that the suspects would harm her. So, detective's like, okay, well, come on in, bring Brittany in tomorrow, and we'll kind of go over that part of the story. So, on Friday, March 18th, Brittany Norwood and her two siblings go down to the station at around 10 a.m. At first, Brittany and the detectives just start making small talk. The detectives just kind of let Brittany take the lead, in a way. But then, unprompted, she brings up why she was there for a third interview. And she said that she wanted to tell them that she left something out of her story. And it was regarding Jana's car. Okay? Now, she had just told them she didn't even know what Jana's car looked like in the previous interview. But this time, she confesses that she actually did get into Jana's car that night. She claimed that her attackers forced her to take Jana's car and move it 3 blocks away to that random parking lot. She went on to say that they threatened to kill her and her family if she tried to run or call for help. So she was left alone to get in Jana's car, drove it 3 blocks away, and was told to walk back by herself. She even claimed that she saw a police officer while walking back, but she didn't say anything because she was too scared. Now, who in the world believes that? Literally nobody, and certainly not the police. However, they didn't let her know that they didn't believe at first. So once they get this story from Brittany, they walk out of the room briefly and basically all agree that they don't believe her story. So they decide to kind of switch things up and start talking to Brittany about her inconsistencies. They go back in and tell her that the story is just not making sense. There's a lot of things that aren't adding up, and they sort of break it down for her and say, you know, what's going on here? Tell us what happened. We need the truth. And she just starts crying, and she's just like, what do you mean? I told you what happened. She said, we've been over this, and Detective Drury says, yeah, but every time we go over it, something else comes out or changes a little. And they basically tell her that she's painted this elaborate picture of a horrific night with two attackers, but it just doesn't make sense. And she continues to stick with her story. And that's when Detective Rubin starts going over specific inconsistencies in her story, sort of laying out everything that proves she could have been a lone attacker. And she gets super quiet, and all she does is ask if she can leave. Obviously, police don't want to let her leave, so they tell her, let's just take a break instead. And they call in her brother Chris and sister Marissa, hoping that they can talk to her, help bring some emotion out of her, and possibly get a confession. Now, Marissa ends up leaving after only a few minutes. It's just too much for her because she's made aware of the evidence against her sister and just becomes emotional and leaves. But Chris comes into the room and he and Brittany are left alone. And he immediately starts telling his sister, look, if you did this, if you had anything to do with this at all, you need to tell me. And at first she denies it. But then he's like, look, you know I won't say anything to the police. Just tell me what happened. That way I know what to say to get you out of this. And that's when Brittany makes the incriminating comment that, quote, she doesn't want to talk about it here. And this is what investigators needed. On March 18th, 2011, just 1 week after the murder, Brittany Norwood is arrested and charged with suspicion of murder against Jana Murray. She was placed in jail until time for her trial. And this absolutely shocks this entire community, especially Jana's family. Nobody at first wanted to believe it, because the community and Jana's family had really rallied behind Brittany. She had sympathy from everyone because she had been there when Jana was murdered. She had supposedly been assaulted and put through something so traumatic. Now everyone finds out that Brittany was the possible killer. It was just mind-blowing. The trial against Brittany Norwood took place 7 months later in October 2011. The trial only lasted 8 days. Charges against Brittany were first-degree premeditated murder and second-degree intent to kill. Brittany's defense lawyer, Douglas Wood, knew by looking at the evidence that they couldn't deny she committed the crime. Prior to the trial, Douglas and the rest of Brittany's team tried to say that Brittany was mentally ill, and they told the judge this on her behalf. They also tried to stop certain statements made by Brittany from being shown in court. However, Judge Robert Greenberg said, quote, "This is a young woman that is totally facile, totally with it, and knew exactly what she was doing." And this was prior to the trial. So, not a good start for Brittany's defense. So, Brittany's team decide to go with the fact that it wasn't premeditated and that she just lost it. In the opening statements, Douglas Wood said, quote, "Ladies and gentlemen, Brittany Norwood lost it. She lost it and she lost control." They described the attack as starting out as a fight between the two women over Brittany being accused of stealing once again, and that Brittany never intended on killing Jana. However, Montgomery County State's Attorney John McCarthy described the murder as a brutal and prolonged attack. He told jurors in his opening statements that Brittany Norwood struck Jana Murray over the head with a metal bar that was part of a merchandise rack. She chased her through the store and kept beating her as she fell to the floor. He said, on March 11th, she savagely ended the life of Jana Murray, and today we begin the process of holding her accountable for the crime she committed, which is first-degree premeditated murder. One thing to note that under Maryland law, premeditation can happen within seconds. It doesn't have to be planned like the day before or something like that. So the defense continued to claim she lost her mind that night and didn't realize what she was doing due to a sort of blackout rage. However, the prosecution made it clear that the fact Brittany was able to claim she was sexually assaulted, which was later proven to be false when medical records were released, and making of the whole story of being beaten by two masked men, the staging of the scene after the fact, all prove that Brittany was fully conscious of her actions the night of the attack. She had time to turn herself in and make things right. The prosecution laid out all of the evidence against Brittany during the trial, including all of the horrific crime scene photos shown in court. And one thing police brought up during trial was why Jana's car needed to be moved. Because there was no other people involved, what was the point in moving Jana's car? Which I thought to myself as well. Well, come to find out, the store manager, Rachel, lived across the street from the Lululemon store. So, the prosecution made it seem that Brittany felt that she had to move Jana's car, just in case Rachel were to wake up and saw it outside, or someone else noticed that her car was still there and wanted to go inside and check on her. All of this just proves how detailed Brittany was. Was she out of her mind that night? In a sense, yes, she had lost her mind, but she knew exactly what she was doing and there was no doubt about it. You don't attack someone for almost 20 minutes or beat them 331 times and not know what you're doing. I'm sorry. At some point, you would think that you would snap out of it and stop. The prosecution lays out a timeline during the trial as well, basically saying that sometime before closing, Jaina either caught Brittany stealing again or made her aware that she knew she had been stealing from the store and already talked to management. After the two leave the store, Brittany makes the decision to get Jaina back into the store alone, and she makes up the story that she lost her Metro card. Once both women were back inside the store, Brittany hits Jaina over the head, and the attack continued from there. Once Jaina was dead, Brittany spent the remainder of the night trying to cover her tracks, staged the scene to look like a robbery by smashing glass, opening registers, etc. She cuts herself to make it look like she had been attacked. She tied herself up and lay there until Rachel came in the following morning. Everything about this attack showed it was worthy of a first-degree murder conviction. And on November 2nd, 2011, shortly before 6 p.m., the jury enters their deliberation, and it only takes them about an hour to deliberate. And Brittany Norwood was found guilty of first-degree murder of Jaina Murray. And on January 27th, 2012, Judge Robert Greenberg sentenced Brittany to life in prison without the possibility of parole. He told Brittany, quote, "You are one hell of a liar." He said also, "After every blow, you had a chance to think about what you were doing." Just before sentencing was read, Brittany addressed Jaina's family and said, "I hope for the Murray family, someday you'll be able to find forgiveness in your heart. I am truly sorry." Jaina Murray's father, David, said, "We want the world to know how strong of an individual she was. She was a beautiful person who had contributed 30 years of beauty to this world." The Lululemon store is still there, and a stained glass mural was added to the storefront in honor of Jaina Murray. This horrific murder seemingly over some stolen leggings. It's disgusting, to be honest. It's very obvious that Brittany had some anger issues. I believe her ex-boyfriend was right. She needed anger management and maybe a psychiatric evaluation. But how did Brittany go so long without being charged with theft? I'm surprised her employer at the previous Lululemon store didn't have her arrested, and maybe if they had, then Jaina would still be alive. It's so sad to think about the missed opportunities here. I mean, if someone is showing signs of anger, stalking, and theft, there's clearly a pattern and they need to be stopped somehow before something like this happens. With that said, that concludes this two-part series of the Lululemon murder, the horrific murder of Jaina Murray. As always, I would love to know your thoughts, so head over to the podcast Instagram page to leave a comment on today's episode post. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe or follow wherever you're listening and leave a 5-star review wherever you're able to. I'll be back here in 2 weeks with another episode. Until then, stay safe. Bye.